Hello there. Today is Tuesday, February 26th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, high expectations for concrete nuclear progress in the second Trump-Kim summit. House Democrats push forward in an effort to stop the president's emergency declaration. Vice President Mike Pence, while in Colombia, says the Trump administration stands with the U.S.-recognized interim president of Venezuela. And the big winner of Sunday night's Academy Awards was diversity. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence told U.S.-recognized interim president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido, that the U.S. is behind him 100%. Pence made the comment during a trilateral meeting in Bogota, Colombia, with Guaido and the Colombian president. While in Bogota, Pence and regional leaders discussed strategy to hasten the departure of disputed Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Joining us now is VOA White House correspondent Patsy Witakuspora. I'm sorry, Patsy.
That's okay.
It's late. How are you? And you've had a long night as well. Thanks for joining us. Tell us what seemed to be the outcome of this trip for the vice president.
So I think other than what Vice President Mike Pence has said in his speech, and we can go through that point by point a little later, for me, the biggest surprise of today was the fact that after yesterday, representatives of Juan Guaido's government, including his ambassador to the Lima Group, who stated on Twitter that Juan Guaido will call for the use of force against Maduro in this forum. Well, in fact, he did not. So he did say all options must be on the table. He did have some very tough languages, but he stressed actually diplomatic efforts. And so the traveling press, including myself, we asked Vice President Mike Pence on the gaggle today, if everybody's saying that all options are on the table, including President Trump, what would it take? What would the red line be? And Vice President Mike Pence basically sidestepped my question and said that, well, that would be something for the President of the United States to determine in consultation with allies. But right now, they're basically just saying that they are taking a new round of sanctions, they're asking to freeze the assets of PDVSA, transfer ownership of Venezuelan assets from Maduro to Guaido, urge nations to restrict visas for Maduro's inner circle, and also to recognize Juan Guaido's representative at the Inter-American Development Bank, and again, another round of sanctions, plus the $56 million additional aid for Guaido, which as of this point, almost none of them have been received. They are still piled up in Brazil and also in Colombia.
What about any efforts to try to have Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro step aside? Did they say how they might possibly work toward doing that or getting him to leave?
You know, at this point, what they're trying to do is exhaust all their diplomatic and economic means, resources, to try to create more and more pressure for the Maduro regime to leave. There's a lot of talk about getting the military to defect from Maduro. By and large, the military are all still very loyal to Maduro. There's probably around 100 or so that have defected, most of them lower ranking. And they're also are hoping that the Venezuelan judiciary will acknowledge Juan Guaido as the legitimate leader. So there's a sense that although there's a consensus in the Lima group that they want to support Juan Guaido, they want to help the Venezuelan people, they're not really prepared to move beyond what they're doing already now, which is sanctions, economic pressure, diplomatic blockade. And so it will take time to kind of see how the situation plays out and if the countries are willing to take any more aggressive action.
And what about the humanitarian aid that's been piling up on the border in Brazil and Colombia?
Yeah, I mean, there's still a standoff between the Maduro forces and the Guaido volunteers. And according to the briefing that I called into with the White House 2 days ago, they're basically saying that Juan Nicolas Maduro is focusing on a couple of bottlenecks, a couple of points of crossings between Brazil and also Colombia. But the border is actually quite large and quite porous, and so they may be able to try to find other points in which to get the aid to get into Venezuela in the coming weeks and months.
Did the vice president have a chance to actually cross over into Venezuela to see the kind of things that are happening there and the situation on the ground, or was it just too dangerous at this point?
Well, there was actually no time because we landed in Bogota at 9 a.m. and then we left at around about 1:30 p.m. And so everything was everything that Mike Pence did today was all in one building. That was a trilateral meeting with Colombian President Iván Duque and also Juan Guaido, and then his remarks to the Lima group, and then meeting with about maybe 60 or so Venezuelan migrants and their families. And that was quite an emotional moment when Mike Pence came in and also Juan Guaido came in, and many of them were crying and many of them were yelling Libertad and then singing the national anthem. But Mike Pence and also Juan Guaido was very well received, and it was quite an emotional moment for everybody there.
Wow, indeed. Well, we will certainly be checking back with you to see how things progress. And we know you're very tired from a very quick flight to and from there. Thank you so much for taking the time to fill us in on what's happening. That's VOA White House correspondent Patsy Witakuswara. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, perhaps the biggest achievement of the first summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un was that it happened at all. And when the two leaders again meet next week or this week, it won't likely be good enough to just have met. We get more now from VOA's Bill Gallo, who is now in Vietnam, where there are high expectations for a second Trump-Kim summit there.
Last year in Singapore, Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un agreed to work toward the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. In Vietnam, there will be pressure to clarify what that idea even means and how to start implementing it. The U.S. wants North Korea to take a tangible step towards dismantling its nuclear weapons, such as destroying a key nuclear site or providing a list of its nuclear and missile inventory. North Korea wants the U.S. to provide sanctions relief, or a formal end to the 1950s Korean War. But the most productive outcome could be an agreement to hand the process off to lower-level officials. There are signs Vietnam will be more substantive than Singapore. In preparation for the summit, U.S. officials have held more working-level meetings with their North Korean counterparts. And in Vietnam, the two sides will have 2 days of meetings rather than just one to make concrete progress on a nuclear deal. Bill Gallo, VOA News.
Well, a group of 58 former U.S. national security officials, both Republican and Democrat, contended on Monday that President Donald Trump had no factual basis to declare a national emergency to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexican border to thwart illegal immigration. Meanwhile, House Democrats are now moving quickly to challenge the president's declaration of national emergency about the border wall to shift billions of dollars from defense to construction of the southern wall. Earlier, I had a chance to speak with VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson about what exactly is defined as a national emergency in the U.S.
Well, a national emergency actually has a very wide definition, and that's something that lawmakers will be looking at when they try to reverse Trump's emergency declaration. There are a number of laws on the books that have different varying definitions, and what they're looking at is whether or not this is an immediate crisis at the border, because in the past, presidents have used national emergency declarations for things like floods, hurricanes, and after September 11th, a terrorist attack. What Democrats are really arguing is that this is not an immediate crisis that national emergencies were meant to address.
But if a president declares a national emergency, is that in itself enough to just have it happen regardless of the definition of a national emergency?
Well, not entirely, because of a law that Congress passed in the 1970s. And basically what that law says is that Congress has the power of the purse. That's the one of the ultimate constitutional authorities of the legislative branch. They set the budget for the United States of America, and they give out the money to pay for that budget. Now, they're saying that because the president signed a budget into law that had lower amounts of border wall funding, this is overstepping his constitutional authority and is going against their power to set the budget for the United States.
Now, this is ultimately going to end up in the courts. There are already a ton of lawsuits over it. Can it actually be reversed in the courts?
Well, with 16 lawsuits and counting, there certainly is a good chance. Of course, there's also a good chance that it'll work its way through the courts and all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And that will take some time. What will happen immediately is the fact that this resolution is going to pass the U.S. House of Representatives. Then it'll go over to the U.S. Senate, where they only need four Republicans to cross the aisle to pass it by a simple majority. But of course, we also heard from President Trump, who said that he would veto it. And it's very, very unlikely that it has a veto-proof majority in the U.S. Senate. So those lawsuits working their way through the court are the best chance for reversing that declaration.
So you're saying that it's very unlikely that what Congress is trying to do to stop this won't have sufficient votes to make this basically veto-proof or bulletproof from the president saying, no, we're going through with this anyway, and the courts will have to work it out?
Almost certainly, because, look, we would have to have a large number of Republicans cross over the aisle. They don't want to anger President Donald Trump. They don't want to be the subject of that next tweet storm. This would be a huge rebuke of him and of his powers.
But if it's going to take months and months and months to get a decision through the courts, wouldn't there be an argument that how can it be an emergency if it's going to take this long to get an answer?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, because President Trump himself said that this wasn't an immediate emergency, is that he actually just was doing this so that it could be done faster down at the border. Also, a lot of Democrats are pointing to the fact that he had control of both chambers of Congress for the first 2 years of his presidency and didn't do anything to address what he called a crisis. There are a number of reasons that tell people that this could have been addressed in another way and without subverting Congress's authority.
Okay, and just finally to wrap this up, can the president actually get the money while it's being fought out in courts and actually start building this wall, or does it get put on hold?
It's my understanding that he is looking to shift money, and that Congress is looking at other ways to block him from doing that. Now, when I was hearing from lawmakers, they were at a very early stage of researching this. I think everybody is trying to figure out where we are in this new uncharted territory of this emergency declaration.
All right. Well, thank you so much for giving us some insight into what's happening with this whole issue. Thanks so much, Catherine.
You're so welcome.
That's VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. The United States has expressed its deep concern about Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir's declaration of a one-year nationwide state of emergency there. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir reports that Bashir's decision made Friday follows 2 months of protests that have rocked Sudan, with calls for the president to step down.
Speaking at a regular UN Security Council briefing Monday on the situation in Sudan's Darfur region, U.S. Acting Ambassador Jonathan Cohen told council members that Washington is evaluating the impact of President Bashir's announcement.
We're deeply concerned about the declaration of a national state of emergency and call on the government of Sudan to respect the rights of all individuals in Sudan, bring an immediate end to the violent repression of peaceful protests, and seek accountability for those responsible for violations and abuses.
In addition to the state of emergency, Bashir dissolved local and national governments as protests grew over a declining economy and rising commodity prices. Ambassador Cohen urged the government to allow demonstrators and opponents of Bashir to express dissent.
We call for an inclusive political process toward elections wherein all Sudanese are able to exercise their rights to freedom of expression, freedom of association, and freedom of peaceful assembly. The immediate release of all journalists, political opposition leaders, human rights activists, and other protesters who've been arbitrarily detained.
Activists say at least 56 people have died during the demonstrations, a figure the government disputes. Bashir has ruled Sudan since 1989 and is wanted by the International Criminal Court for alleged war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide in Darfur. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
A high-level pledging conference for the humanitarian crisis in Yemen this week will seek international support for 19 million people who are suffering from years of conflict and deprivation. These issues prompting this emergency gathering ahead of Tuesday's one-day event. The issues prompting the gathering. In December, the UN asked for a record $4.2 billion for Yemen, the largest single country appeal ever launched. By any measure, though, the situation in Yemen is catastrophic. The UN calls it the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. It also reports about 80% of the population, 24 million people need humanitarian assistance and protection. A UN humanitarian affairs spokesman tells VOA that the suffering of Yemen's civilian population has reached a scale not seen in living memory. With less than 2 months to go before scheduled presidential elections in Algeria, protesters have begun to take to the streets of major Algerian towns and cities to signify their opposition to a fifth term for veteran President Abdelaziz Bouteflika, who is now confined to a wheelchair following a serious stroke in 2013. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Large crowds of anti-Bouteflika protesters have taken to the streets of the capital, Algiers, as well as the key coastal cities of Annaba and Oran in recent days. Protests have also been reported in smaller towns and cities. Arab media broadcast video of police firing tear gas in Algiers Sunday to break up demonstrations. No serious casualties were reported. A group of lawyers heard here also chanted the familiar Arab Spring slogan calling for the ouster of the government while outside the main courthouse in Algiers on Monday. Prime Minister Ahmed Ould Yahia said in a speech to Parliament Monday that authorities are not opposed to demonstrations so long as they remain peaceful. Ould Yahia says the Algerian constitution guarantees the right of citizens to gather peacefully, and so far protests have remained peaceful. He warns, however, against protest calls from unknown parties and said they could turn violent. Bouteflika, president since 1999, traveled to Switzerland late Sunday for what his office called routine medical checks. Former Prime Minister Abdelmalek Al-Salal, who is Bouteflika's campaign manager, said in a nationally televised speech several days ago that most people understand that the situation in the country is delicate. He said support for the incumbent president was even stronger than the last time he ran in 2014. He claims that there have been even more signatures in support of the president's candidacy than there were in 2014, and that this shows a complete acceptance on the national level for his remaining in office. Key bastions of support appear to be eroding, however. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that the behind-the-scenes political movers and shakers appear to be quarreling among themselves, with their dissension erupting into the open. He says that until the latter part of President Bouteflika's current term in office, there was a sort of tacit entente among the country's main power centers, including the intelligence services, the military, the police, and the president's entourage. The situation, he maintains, became more complicated in the second half of last year when measures were taken against some key political figures and generals. Abu Diab says the situation has now become complicated and risks getting out of control because a segment of the country's top power brokers may have allowed the current protests to get out of hand. These same forces, however, were taken aback, according to Abu Diab, after protesters demanded not only an end to Bouteflika's term in office, but also for the fall of the regime. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Well, the Red Cross and the Red Crescent movement are pledging to scale up action to prevent and end sexual and gender-based violence in situations of conflict. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the two humanitarian bodies have launched a plan for tackling the issue of rape as a weapon of war.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says he has met many victims of rape and brutal sexual violence in war zones from the Democratic Republic of Congo to the former Yugoslavia. Guterres says he has heard firsthand accounts from Rohingya refugees who were gang raped while trying to escape violence in Myanmar. He says the place and circumstance of the abuse may differ, but the pain and trauma remain the same.
Let me be clear. Sexual and gender-based violence in conflict is not only a horrendous and life-changing crime, most often perpetrated against women and girls. It is also used as a tactic of war to terrorize families, dehumanize communities, and destabilize societies so that they struggle to recover for years or even decades after the guns fall silent.
Guterres says sexual and gender-based violence in conflict is now widely recognized as a war crime that is preventable and punishable. Julienne Lusange is a Congolese human rights activist. She is president of the group SOFPADI and the director of the Congolese Women's Fund. For her, the suffering endured by women and young girls who have been violated by men at war is an everyday personal matter. She speaks through an interpreter.
And during this month of February, our medical center, Karibuni Wamama in Bunia, received in 1 week 28 children who were victims of serious sexual offenses, including a baby of 2 years. We continue to see women who have been captives held by various different armed groups in our regional offices.
Not only are these women used as sex slaves, but she says they also are victims of forced marriages, forced labor, physical and psychological violence, and inhuman and degrading treatment. Lausanne says her organization provides survivors of these atrocities medical, psychological, and legal support. She says in the past 20 years, her group has been organizing socioeconomic rehabilitation for victims. She says the communities as a whole, traditional leaders, young people, and survivors themselves are involved in this struggle. She speaks through an interpreter.
Today, the International Committee of the Red Cross is launching an appeal of $27 million to help us better respond to sexual violence in 14 key countries, including expanded services in Colombia, improved responses in Syria, and new services in Central African Republic. For the first time, we will place dedicated specialists in 6 countries this year to increase the field coordination and response of the ICRC.
The president of the International Committee of the Red Cross, Peter Mora, says sexual violence too often is accepted as an inevitable byproduct of war. He says this must end. He says the law is clear that rape and other forms of sexual violence are a violation, and those guilty of these crimes must be held accountable and punished. Mora says the ICRC will do more on behalf of victims.
Women come to us as victims, but they go home as agents of change. Once they have been instructed on their rights and on the laws which punish sexual violence, they join the fight at our side.
Among its many recommendations, the UN and ICRC are urging governments to ensure survivors of sexual and gender-based violence and conflict receive adequate protection. They are calling for measures to protect detainees from sexual abuse. They also say governments must provide training for police and armed forces to prevent these atrocities from occurring. They agree with Julien Lusange, who says it is time to stop using women's bodies as battlefields. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways, including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar.
Sporty greetings to all our VOA listeners. This is Sonny Young, host of The Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me at 1630 and 1830 UTC, Monday through Friday, for special World Cup updates during the month-long football festival in Russia, right here on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. While diversity was perhaps the biggest winner in Sunday night's Academy Awards on a night when a beloved black filmmaker won his first competitive Oscar, a superhero blockbuster set in Africa scored big, and two black actors and an Egyptian first-generation American won three of four acting prizes. And in a twist ending that shocked many, Peter Farrelly's Green Book, a heartwarming drama about the friendship between an eclectic African-American musician and his uncouth white driver during the segregation era, won three Academy Awards, including Best Picture. VOA's Penelope Pulu has all the details.
This gentleman says that I'm not permitted to dine here. I'm afraid not.
How does he smile and shake their hands like that?
Because it takes courage to change people's hearts.
Green Book's Mahershala Ali, who plays Don Shirley, won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. The film also won the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay. Actor Viggo Mortensen and Green Book filmmaker Peter Farrelly spoke to VOA about the film.
And he directed it so well that it almost looks easy, almost looks effortless. But I've read thousands of scripts, and I've written three, and I know how difficult it is to find the right balance between, you know, in the case of Green Book, dramatic tension, humor, but that's organic, that comes from a situation, from contrast between characters, great dialogue that's sparkling, that's intelligent, that has subtext to it, and a story that has a rhythm and a pace that is steady and just keeps improving. And underneath all of that, you have really a history lesson.
Green Book's wins were emblematic of this year's awards, which were all about diversity. Alfonso Cuarón's Roma also won three Oscars for Best Cinematography, Best Foreign Language Film, and Best Director. The story, told from the perspective of an indigenous Mexican housemaid, pays tribute to female domestic workers worldwide. In his acceptance speech, Cuarón thanked his two female stars, Marina de Tavira and Yalitza Aparicio, for being the heart of Roma. Roma might not have risen to such prominence had it not been produced by Netflix and streamed into millions of households all over the world. Online viewing platforms are exposing diverse films to the world, says George Mason University media expert Richard Craig.
The objective is hopefully that it opens up doors and opportunities for those voices that typically do not have the ability to compete and have their storylines and their content valued at the highest level.
Olivia Colman won the Oscar for Best Actress for her role as Queen Anne in the European film The Favorite by Yorgos Lanthimos.
That was VOA's Penelope Pulu reporting. You have been listening to International Edition on VOA. Thanks so much for joining us. That does it for today's show. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
This is VOA News. I'm